Park Place meeting, Tuesday morning, 15th June 1976. As all of you will will have gathered from the letter which was in your room when you arrived, our theme for this week is self-discipline. Self-discipline has meaning and significance for us if we understand the nature and the purpose of our existence. We can summarize this quite briefly. Regarding the nature of our existence, if we study what we have discovered through the centuries regarding the development of man, we see a trend in the direction of greater refinement, greater sensitivity, and greater responsivity. That is something, at least, of the nature. The purpose of our existence has, of course, been expressed in so many different ways. But I think that in the context, particularly in the context of religion and the religious life, which, let us always remember, includes the whole of life, we may say that the purpose of our existence is to bring about maturity. Maturity of body is largely, almost exclusively, the task of nature. It can be hampered by us through our ignorance, through accident, through deliberate flouting of the laws, the simple laws of nature, with regard to food, drink, exercise, and so forth. And it can be hindered through our mental drawbacks and drawbacks of our daily behavior, our daily conduct in life. But apart from that, it is nature which brings the body to maturity. There is the profounder aspect, bringing the mind to maturity. Nature has gifted us with our psychophysical constitution. But mind as mind and its development is our personal responsibility. Nature, in the ordinary dictionary meaning of the word, does not deal with this. This is where we, as self-conscious individual human beings, have to play our part, bringing the mind to maturity. And of course, one of the greatest illnesses of the human race consists in the fact that so few human beings ever bring the mind to maturity. Of course, one may understand why this is so. The human race is very young yet, a bare 3 or 4 million years. And as far as we are aware, we have perhaps something like 2,000 million years yet to run, granting that no cataclysm on a cosmic scale will render conditions on Earth impossible for human beings to survive, or that human beings themselves will exterminate themselves as a species. That is a very remote possibility, but it is there. So that we can well understand that being very young and having this task of finding out things for ourselves, we labor under difficulties. The human race as a whole hasn't got something older than the human race to hand on that kind of knowledge which will enable us to bring the mind to maturity more easily than we have done so far. There are only the relatively few in human history who, having realized human fulfillment in the supreme sense, have left pointers of light to our progress towards our own fruition. They are, of course, those whom we call the holy ones, the great spiritual teachers, teachers in the true sense, and the founders of the great religions, and so forth. So, our purpose is to realize maturity of mind. And when that maturity of mind comes into being, the whole psychophysical organism is truly a healthy organism. That is the state of true health, the state of wholeness. In Zarathustrian terms, haurvatat, holiness or wholeness. It's a lovely word in the Avastan language, haurvatat. And that haurvatat is always accompanied by the realization of ameritat, immortality, here and now whilst we are alive, immortality. So you will see a wonderful indication of the true meaning of immortality. It is not a continuation in time and space as a finite, separate being, but a realization of wholeness here now through the release of our own physical and mental maturity. We can put it in other terms. Our purpose is to first realize true egohood, which means complete individuality within the confines of our own organism, the psychophysical organism. We must grow in such a way, and here upbringing and education and so on play their part. We must grow in such a way that we are a harmonious whole within ourselves. And the specific characteristic distinguishing this is that we are self-conscious with a sense of true self-responsibility towards ourself and towards our whole environment. Then that is true egohood. When one has realized that true egohood, we can proceed to the next and the final stage concerned, which concerns us as human creatures, that of realizing individuality, true individuality in the supreme sense. That is to say, we are no longer conscious of ourselves and the environment in terms of the functioning of any sort of isolativeness in our consciousness. Instead of being conscious of I and you or they or things or the country or the state or whatever it is, instead of being conscious in that way, we are now naturally, spontaneously conscious in terms of us, not of you and I. It's just a consciousness of us, in which the clear awareness of finite objects, of separate people, is not lost, but is fully integrated into the complete whole. Now this is the full meaning of haurvatat and ameritat. Wholeness and immortality, which always go together. This is the fulfillment of true yoga, if you like, of the life of the mystic, of the life of the religious. And we may perhaps formulate the purpose of our existence somewhat along such lines. We can put it in still another way. Each single person has grown into the living vehicle for transcendence itself. He is, to use a Christian phrase, himself the Holy Grail. And it is a grail which has no boundaries to it. It is not a particular cup of any sort, but it is the universal cup. What I mean is that the whole universe is this cup, which is extraordinarily, inexplicably embodied in the small cup, which is the individual. But this small cup, the individual, because that individual has grown into full awareness of totality, is freed of the limitations imposed upon it by the actual physical boundaries that make up the cup, namely one's own psychophysical organism. Now, if we look at the situation in this way, regarding the nature and the purpose of our existence, then self-discipline has a pure meaning. Until then, it has a tainted meaning, because any sort of discipline that we undergo, either because it is imposed upon us or because we impose it upon ourselves, is self-oriented. It is a discipline which excludes us from the totality. I want to achieve this, to realize that, to fulfill such and such an ambition, and so on and so on. I want to fulfill such and such a purpose which I have in life. All that goes out when one sees the true nature of our purpose, of the purpose of our existence. The selfness is out. The separativeness is out. And why is that so very important? Because, as far as we know, at least as far as I know, on this planet, the only creature who can obstruct this wholeness, who can break asunder this holiness, is man alone, who can impose his self-consciousness, his egoistic egohood, against the stream of life. So now, self-discipline, then, in the religious sense, through the understanding of the nature and purpose of our existence, begins to have a true meaning. It spells release, therefore, from self-bondage. Because all our desires and ambitions and so forth, which are self-oriented, bind the self. They do not liberate the self. Anything in the way of achievement and attainment, of gain, of self-aggrandizement and so forth, is a binding of the self. So, true self-discipline spells release from this self-bondage. And true self-discipline, starting with ourselves as we are, must of necessity be a learning of the ways of the self in two main aspects. One is in terms of the self as it is now, the growing of complete perception of our own selfness. We have to be able to perceive the selfness in all that we think and feel, all that we say, all that we do. This hidden canker within the soul, this worm inside the apple, so to say, selfness. We have to learn then the ways of the self as it functions bound by selfness. And in learning that, if we truly perceive it, it is impossible to avoid learning the ways of the self in terms of unselfness. We cannot directly learn the ways of unselfness, because the natural condition, the pure condition, the primordial divine condition, if you like, is that of perfection, is that of unselfness. You find this formulated in so many different ways in all the great religious teachings of the world. But the person, being in bondage to self, have my vision and understanding clouded, befogged by the selfness. And in that state, the mind cannot see truly. So what I try to see in the so-called positive sense is always a distorted vision, a seeing through colored glasses. But what I can see directly as that which hinders pure vision is something with which I am at home, because I am in that condition. And when I see that, really see it, the dissolution of that element of fog takes place. The cloud is dispersed and there is light. We haven't got to make the light, to see the light. The light is there. But the fog proceeds out of us. And it is we alone who can see that fog and clear it. The seeing is the clearing. I can never repeat this too often. Where the discipline and growth of the mind is concerned, the doctor, the diagnosis, and the medicine and cure are one and the same. They aren't different, as is the case in our ordinary physical life and illness. The doctor is, I am the ill person, the doctor is another person, the medicine he gives is a third substance. Then there's a fourth element, I've got to take the medicine. Now in the case of the mind, it is different. It may be thought that our developments in modern psychology and psychotherapy seem to falsify what I am saying. But consider this matter very deeply. What another person says with the intention of helping you to see will certainly stimulate you, make you use your mind, make you try to see. But you can't see truly, because fundamentally you are conscious in terms of separativeness. Right at the very start, you are isolatively conscious. The world and I. The other person and I. And it is because one is conscious in that manner, there is this perpetual barrier between the so-called other and myself. This is the great difficulty, the supreme difficulty. And why does it remain the supreme difficulty? Because we have this absurd belief in a separate entity called the immortal soul or being, or use whatever term you like, or you can use the term essence of mind if you like, and think you've escaped the trap of the theistic theology. But what is this essence of mind? Put it inside a bottle, smell it, taste it, show it to me. What is this essence of mind? You cannot hold it, you cannot produce it. You cannot manifest it as your essence of mind. You haven't got an essence of mind. Essence of mind is a phrase to represent the ultimate reality, which is the unknown and the unknowable by the brain. It is the universal, the immeasurable. It belongs to a context which utterly negates permanent separateness and absolutely affirms total relationship in one incredible whole. So you see, we suffer from this plague from the moment that we are born till the moment we die. My soul, my spirit, my progress, therefore, and all the rest of it. Therefore you can't see truly because of that consciousness. And your psychotherapist or any other person can never get at your consciousness. The perfected Holy One himself, by his very presence, might so inspire you, exert such a healing, peaceful influence on you, that your own mind in the sixth state can become perfectly still and quiet. And in that stillness and quietness, your consciousness undergoes that transformation. Because of which, this fundamental root of conflict, of evil, dukkha in the true sense, that fundamental root dissolves within you. You can't achieve it by desiring it, by wanting to do it. It will happen if you let it happen by being utterly quiet and still. Let the mind be utterly quiet and still, undesirous. And there you have it. So you see, when one sees the ways of the self, and one sees, this is selfness at work, you really have seen it, then in that moment you become quiet, you become still. You don't seek knowledge which is formulated knowledge and think that this formulation is the truth. I've got hold of the truth. You see? Then the state of unselfness supervenes. You are it, at least for the time being. Because remember that the transformation of the whole psyche is no simple or easy task. And time is involved in it. Time is not involved in it in that flashing moment of true perception, and the state of liberation prevails, but the state of unliberation overcomes us again afterwards. There comes the time when at last every vestige of impurity is out of the soul, out of the mind, and then there is the realization of true unselfness. So now, self-discipline is a learning of the ways of the self in bondage. And this is what we mean by learning the ways of the self. Being fully aware of how selfness is functioning through me. Not learning all the jargon of psychology or metaphysics or anything else you like, all the jargon of scriptural talk, of religious explanation or whatever it is. It is a living process, not an acquiring process. And the two are very, very different. An acquiring process is a burdening process. You can acquire knowledge in 50 books, 100 books, 1,000 books, goodness knows what. And you will be just crushed under that load of knowledge. But if you live what you see, then you are free of that burden of knowledge. And you realize that it is you who are the source of knowledge. You are the releaser of the forms of knowledge into the world, which may inspire somebody else for the time being, but for you they have no further use. What you actually know is now useless to you. You, the living being, throw out knowledge, throw out ideas, conceptions. But once you've thrown them out, those who are not at that stage may find them useful and inspiring, but you have to be free of them. So that within you, the faculty of pure intelligence, the power of pure intelligence keeps growing. And this is one of the great meanings of discipline. The learning which is a growing of the mind towards maturity, a growing of the mind in such a manner that it is constantly pouring forth knowledge out of you. Not necessarily in words and thoughts, but by your very presence, you are spreading knowledge. I remember so well the days when I used to go to Solomon for my piano lessons. Things which I could never play to myself at home, in his presence, somehow or other, on certain occasions, would come out beautifully, perfectly, as never at home. On many other, and most other occasions, the reverse situation held good. In the presence of a great man, I'd be so nervous and awkward that everything would go wrong. Why? Isolative self-consciousness. Am I going to play to him satisfactorily? Therefore I couldn't. But when I was really free of that, then in his presence everything happened beautifully and wonderfully. Now, Let us spend a few moments considering a very simple first steps, kindergarten steps. Quietness and silence, I've talked about so much that silence is no longer silent. I'll talk about something which every one of you has heard about. Good manners. Just plain, straightforward, good manners. Has it ever struck us that good manners is a freeing oneself from the state of disunity with our neighbor? Whether our neighbor happens to be a human being or an animal or a garden or a steam engine or even these electrical gadgets and instruments surrounding me here. That's my neighbor. Everything is my neighbor. And good manners is a freeing of myself from the state of disunity with my neighbor. It is a natural, spontaneous expression of an invisible grace. And the creative link distinguishing that invisible grace is that a relationship between myself and my neighbor is utterly unspoilt in any way whatsoever by any defilement in myself. It is associated with considerateness. Considerateness for everybody. And true considerateness, which is rooted in compassion and in which the sense of otherness is totally absent, is something which is wonderfully expressed in the lives of the great ones, the holy ones. This considerateness, which is one of the high peaks of the expression of good manners. You know, in the life of the Buddha, as portrayed in the Pali Canon, we have some wonderful presentations of the manners of the Buddha. There is a remarkable discourse, well, all the discourses are quite remarkable, called the Brahmayu Sutta. Sutta is just the discourse. And Brahmayu is the name of a venerable Brahman who was 120 years of age after meeting the Buddha. Shortly afterwards he died. This sounds as if he died because he met the Buddha, but that isn't the case. Brahmayu had heard about the Buddha. So he sent one of his disciples to observe whether the Buddha had all the marks on his body of the great man, capital G, capital M. You must read the discourse. It has some curious aspects. If you take the physical description literally, you'll find that this is an impossible creature. For instance, he had 40 teeth. His arms were almost up to his knees, came down right down to his knees. His ankles were in the middle of his legs, and so on. Some strange statements of that type, you will find. But as regards his behavior, we have some very interesting things. His behavior is marked by perfect moderation, by perfect grace, complete absence of any slovenliness, the utter absence of making his presence felt, no crude behavior in any way whatsoever. And as regards his eating habits, the revered Gotama eats food not for fun or indulgence or personal charm or beautification, but just enough for the support of his body, for keeping it going, for keeping it unharmed, which means he wasn't unintelligent, careless about what he ate, for furthering the holy life. Then, when he has eaten, he sits silent for a moment, but he does not let pass the time for giving thanks. When he has eaten, he gives thanks. You will find the same sort of thing in all the other great religions of the world. This grace, the idea of grace at meals and all the rest of it. It is there. Recognizes it is a communion.
Then again, regarding his manner of speaking, the sound that issues from the revered Gotama's mouth is possessed of 8 characteristics. It is distinct and intelligible, sweet, audible and fluent, clear, deep and resonant. And they say, and it is also said, he never spoke too loudly, he never spoke too softly. His voice carried to the whole assembly present. And remember that time and again the record says that there were 1,250 of the monks assembled together.
And there was no electronic apparatus of any sort available in those days. So he had to speak in such a manner that everyone heard him clearly. If he spoke to one person, well, that one person just heard him, without having to strain his ears and say, oh, I beg your pardon, what are you saying? Nor squirming under the bellow that came out of the man's mouth. Sweet, gentle, audible, clear, fluent, deep, resonant. Now this is good manners, surely, isn't it? There is another very remarkable discourse in the long discourses called the Ambattha Sutta, in which a famous Brahmin, Pokkarasadi by name, has heard about the Buddha and sends one of his disciples named Ambattha, together with other Brahmins, to visit the Buddha and find out whether the report about him and his behavior and all that is quite true. The Buddha himself opens the door, and all the other Brahmins accompanying Ambattha exchange the greetings and compliments of politeness and courtesy with him, but Ambattha himself behaves arrogantly and rudely. And the Buddha calls him in, of course, and finds out the reason for this behavior. The reason is simply this. Ambattha says he is of Brahmin descent, whereas the Buddha was a member of the Kshatriya, the warrior caste. He was the son of a prince, or chieftain, or king, or whatever you like to say. But he did not belong to the highest caste, the Brahmin. Now, the Buddha must have had a fantastic knowledge of the people around him and those who came to visit him. He spoke gently and pointed out that Ambattha's lineage up to 7 generations back showed that he was not of pure Brahmin descent. And then the Buddha goes on to say that where the religious life is concerned, where the true wisdom which leads to liberation, to nirvana, to fulfillment is concerned, there is no question of caste or lineage or descent or anything like that. Ambattha, having been shown the truth about himself in no uncertain terms, but spoken with great understanding and gentleness by the Buddha, then asks the Buddha, but what is this wisdom and knowledge? And the Buddha teaches him with the same fullness and love as he taught anybody and everybody. Now, is this good manners? And does manners then mean something merely mean something external? Or is it the living, perfect, beautiful expression of an inward and a spiritual grace? An inward realization. Now, this element of manners, of good conduct, as the Buddhists called it, forms the early stage of self-discipline. And I'll stop there now for this morning, and we'll pursue our inquiry into the meaning of self and discipline as we go on.